This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. All right, everybody. This is the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, and I am your host, Dan Johnson. Welcome once again. If this is your first time ever, I hope you're not underwhelmed with listening to this podcast. But if it is your first time, we have one hell of a guest for you today, Mr. Mark Kenyon. Mark, how are we doing, buddy?
I'm great. Even better now being with you. We don't get to do this enough, so it's always... No. I'm always thrilled. And whenever I see the invite, it's a no questions asked immediate yes. So yes. I'm glad we're here.
And then it becomes just a scheduling. It just becomes a scheduling thing. So,
which can be complicated these days with our both of our crazy lives, but
exactly.
This is great. Glad to be here.
Exactly. Exactly. I know you got to get out of here. You have a hard stop today, and I want to cover a lot of things regarding public lands and policies, a recent trip that you had to Washington, D.C., things like that. And I feel like I want to kind of dive into it. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to send a huge shout out to all of the partners really quick of the Nine Finger Chronicles. If you're looking for a broadhead, go check out wasparchery.com, discount code NFC20, Vortex Optics, some of the best optics in the game. It's still turkey season, so put a red dot on your turkey shotgun, vortexoptics.com, code Blue Sense, whether you are a fan of real or synthetic deer urine, scent elimination products, the Rope-A-Dope Mock Scrape Kit that I'm a huge fan of. Go check out codebluesense.com, discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Then we have Reveal Trail Cameras, badass trail cameras. I know that they're about to do some really crazy things with cell cams, so go check out tacticam.com/cameras. And then we have my company, fullsneakgear.com, if you want a t-shirt with a deer on it. All right.
Dude, you're good at that.
Yeah. Yep. Got to not just knock it out. Now we got a big conversation. Talk to me a little bit about this new role that you've been put into or that has been created for you or within Meat Eater.
Yeah. So the new gig is Director of Conservation. Mm-hmm. And so you can kind of think about my role at Meat Eater now having like two, it's kind of split in the middle. One side of my role at Meat Eater is the same that it's been for the last 8 years, which is, you know, what we call like our crew. I'm the face of a bunch of our video series. I am the voice of some of our podcasts, you know, the Wired to Hunt podcast, of course, that you and I have been a part of for so long. That's all still continuing. So I'm filming, doing podcasts, doing content, just as usual. But this new part of my role, this other half of my role, is, you know, taking over, driving our content and kind of advocacy and program strategy for everything related to conservation at Meat Eater. So, you know, that means I'm launching a new podcast here soon that's more specifically about conservation related stuff. It means that some of the films and video series that I'm doing will now be more conservation focused, not just whitetail focused like a lot of my stuff has been in the past.
Right.
That means that, you know, I'm kind of directing how we talk about conservation issues and public land issues and all that kind of stuff. So I'm working with our social team to develop all of our social media materials related to this stuff. I'm, you know, working with our editorial team to figure out what articles do we write about this stuff and what's our position and what should we be covering and talking about? How do we talk about it? I'm spearheading our big conservation grant program. We have this thing called the Land Access Initiative, in which we raise money and then donate that money to create new public access opportunities across the nation. So finding those projects, leading those projects, all that kind of stuff. Basically anything that Meat Eater is going to do that has a conservation impact or focus, I'm in charge of making happen.
Okay.
So that's kind of a 30,000 foot overview of what I'm trying to tackle now.
All right. All right. Recently, you've had your foot in the door of this like public land thing that's happening, right? Trying to stop the sale of public lands, trying to prevent mines going up that could potentially affect public lands. When I hear the word conservation, I've never really put conservation and public land in the same bucket per se. How does conservation and public land kind of meet together?
Yeah. So I've always thought the kind of the opposite. In my like head, I've thought of that being like something that lives underneath the conservation umbrella. When I think about conservation, I think about anything that is trying to protect, manage, steward, or conserve any of our natural resources and or those programs that protect and manage those resources. So our natural resources being wildlife, land, water, you know, the base level, it's those things, right? The animals, the ground, and the water they live in. And then we have public land systems and agencies and designations that protect the land part of that. We have agencies and protections that protect and manage the water side of that. And then, of course, we have agencies and designations that protect and manage the wildlife side of that. So I think when it comes to conservation work or advocacy, it can be interacting with any one of those things. So it might be, you know, actually getting out there on the ground and improving habitat. It could be engaging in, you know, hunting regulations because that impacts wildlife populations. It could be going to DC and advocating for protections for our public lands or making sure they don't sell off public lands like you mentioned. I think it could be any of these different things, but anything that impacts land, water, wildlife, and you can even throw in our hunting and fishing rights even. I think that even has like an impact on conservation. I think all that stuff lives underneath that umbrella.
Gotcha. Do you see yourself in your role and with the group of people that you work with staying at a federal level or even going as like almost like a Howl for Wildlife, right? Well, where they will see a discrepancy in a rule and regulation or a policy within a state, and then they send action items out for specific people within that state to go do. Do you see yourself at a broader federal level, or do you see this getting to the point where Mark Kenyon's going to be like, hey, man, there are some bogus things happening in the state of Tennessee. We got to address it.
Yeah. So there's a couple angles to this that I would bring up. I think, you know, number one, we exist in a different space than like a Howl does, right? You know, Howl or TRCP or BHA or the NDA or anything like that, right? They are 100% focused on advocacy. They're a nonprofit that's dedicated to this kind of stuff. You know, Meat Eater is a media company that also owns a several manufacturing brands, right? We own Ursula, we own Phelps, etc. So we're a corporation, but we are a corporation with a strong conservation ethic and mission tied to it. So we have similar aims to like a Howl or a TRCP in many ways, but we approach it from a different perspective because we don't have 20 or 30 people that are dedicated just to like that side of things. We have a me, and then I then try to leverage and find resources within the company to help approach, you know, attack some of these things. But there's also the rest of the company doing all the other things that this company does, like create content, create media, make clothing, etc. So I look at our role as two things. One, Meat Eater has this huge platform and megaphone. And so with that, with like great opportunity to reach people, I think comes with a responsibility to use that. And we, I think all of us who came to Meat Eater, came to work here for a reason, right? When Steve founded it, when I got started early on, the reason I did it is because I saw like, we have this opportunity to be leaders in this community and try to represent hunting and fishing in a positive way that's going to help the future, and then help to make sure we have places to hunt and fish and to make sure we have wildlife and fish to go out there and enjoy, right? I always viewed that as a huge part of why we were doing this and the responsibility we have given the fact that so many people pay attention. So that's a big part of it. It's like, if we're going to have this company, if we're going to do all these things, we better damn well work really hard to work for a better future, given all that. So So that's why we do it. That's how we think about it. Now, as far as, you know, national versus state level, this is where it comes down to like bandwidth. Given the fact that this is a slice of what we do, it's a big part of what I personally am doing now, but for the broader company, there's all these other things everybody's working on. There's no physical way that we could have a position and have a campaign or efforts to attack every single issue out there, right? There's right. so many different things going on across the country that are all good and important and worth attention, but there's simply no way that I would be able to have a clear idea of what's going on and really be able to, you know, devote energy to that, that it deserves in an accurate, effective way. So what I try to do, what I've been trying to do as I'm getting my feet under me with this, is to look at issues. You know, we're going to have a handful of things that are like top priority for us that we actually could make a difference on and can put some extra energy behind. Those would be like our top tier issues. And then there's some things that are just going to be in the bucket of, okay, this is pretty important and it affects a lot of people in our audience, but it's something, you know, we can, you know, educate about, we could put some information out there about, but we probably don't have the bandwidth to dive really deep into this.
Yeah.
And then there's going to be other issues that are like, hey, you know, yeah, this is important, but it's not directly relevant to our core audience, or it's so niche that it's just a small slice of our core audience. So I'm looking at a kind of a, like a Venn diagram. One side of the Venn diagram is this directly relevant to a big part of our audience? Number two, is this like really important and will impact the future of hunting and fishing and the opportunities to do that? That's like one side of the Venn diagram. Mm-hmm. And then the other side of the Venn diagram, at least for these top tier issues, the other side of the Venn diagram is, can we make a difference? Mm-hmm. If this is like an issue that is super, is important, but there's zero ability for us to help, or if there's zero ability for us to actually make a difference at this point, maybe because it's already a decision's made or whatever, maybe that's not worth all of our time and energy. Maybe that's just to inform the public about it, but we're not going to put a bunch of money behind it or resources behind it. The stuff in the middle, where it's relevant to our audience, it's really important, and we have a chance to make a difference, where that stuff meets in the middle is where our highest priority lies, because we can actually make a difference and it's important to hunters and anglers across the nation. So that's a bunch of stuff. It's a long winding answer to tell you that I'm constantly trying to pass everything through a filter of what's relevant, what's important, where can we help, and try to put our, you know, resources and time there.
Gotcha. I mean, that makes a lot of sense, because you can't handle everything at one time, right?
Yeah. And I've definitely found, one thing I've found since starting in this role is there's so many people out there looking for help.
Yes.
I get so much inbound, like, hey, here's this issue. Hey, here's this thing. Here's this thing. Here's this thing. And I'd love for us to be able to help with all of it. I wish we could. But it's like overwhelming and impossible. So yeah, a big part of what I'm trying to do now is filter, find how can we help, where can we help, when does it make sense? And then also, you know, hopefully point people in the direction of other folks who can engage too.
Yeah. So with that said, then, how does Mark Kenyon or Meat Eater come up with a mission statement or a mission where there's bullet points that you're trying to accomplish for this new position and the overall goal of improving conservation with whatever it is you're trying to accomplish? This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code NFC at checkout for 20% off on all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
Yeah. So from the inception of Meat Eater, from the earliest days, you know, within our founding documents, you know, there was some language around the fact that, you know, we view nature as sacred. We view the, you know, perpetuation of hunting and fishing and wildlife and wild places as core to who we are and what we're going to do. So right from the very beginning, that was built into our DNA. Like, that's our why. We love this stuff. We live this stuff. So if we're going to build a business, if we're going to talk about this stuff and storytell around this stuff, it better be with the aim of making the future better for all of that. Yeah. So that's core to who we are. The actual role that I'm in now has been a little bit of a build it as you go kind of thing, right? Ryan Callahan had this job before me. And so he brought his unique experience, his unique kind of strengths and focus areas to that job. And so he was based in Montana and really engaged on the public land side of things, working, he was on the board for Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. So he brought in like a strong focus on that side, and experience and interest on that side of things. When Cal left to become the CEO of BHA, that opened up that role. And for years, I had been doing a lot of conservation related projects and stuff at Meteor. I've been helping Cal with a lot of these things. So when he left, it was kind of the natural next step for me to move into that. But it was funny when this opportunity was offered to me, I asked, okay, like what are the roles going to, what's the responsibilities going to be? What's my job description? And I was kind of told, well, you tell us, you build what you want it to be and you make it what you want it to be. And so those bullet points you asked about, I'm still in the process of figuring all of that out and building that out for me and really trying to figure out, okay, back to, a little bit of what we were just talking about, where can we make the greatest impact? How can I use the platforms that we have? How can I use the connections we have? How can I use the experience and expertise that I have to maximize the positive good we can make in the world? And that's the coolest thing about this gig for me is, since way back in the day, Dan, when you and I were just starting the Wired to Hunt podcast, right around that time period was when I was really starting to think, okay, how do I use this to make sure we can keep doing these things we love? How can I make sure, we had conversations back in like 2013 or 2014 is, I was starting to learn like, oh, wow, we only have these amazing deer populations because people helped restore them. Oh, wow, we only have these public lands for you and I go on an elk hunt because people stood up and fought for them. So as I was learning about all that, I started thinking like, man, how can I be part of that too? How can I be a part of that next group of people to fight that fight and make sure that our kids still have these opportunities? So in this role, I've been just trying to figure out, okay, how do I use this like incredible set of tools we have, incredible set of resources we have to get the best bang for our buck? And so a big part of that is looking at what's Meat Eater good at, what's our unique skill set, what can we do better than some, what can we not do as well as some. So I'll give you an example. Over the last couple months, end of 25, I spent a bunch of time talking to a lot of folks across the conservation world, across the hunting and fishing world. I'd set up like one-on-one meetings with all these different leaders and people in these organizations and basically asked, what do you need help on? Where are the major challenges? Where are the problems? What are the things that could really make a difference for you and for your cause and for these issues out there? What can Meat Eater do even better? How could we be, the greatest possible asset to the future of these things? And I heard a lot of different ideas. And one thing I expected everybody to say was money. I thought everyone would say, hey, we need more money. We need your funding. Will you sponsor this? Will you support this? Will you pay for this? And I heard that a little bit. But more than anything, they were like, hey, we need attention. We need people to know about this issue or about our organization or about this opportunity to engage. And Meat Eater uniquely has the ability to capture more attention than almost anyone. And so that was the big thing. Everyone was like, hey, please use your megaphone. Please use your platform. Please use your podcast or your YouTube show or whatever it is to help us get this out to the world. So a large part of what I'm focusing on now is how do we use that our secret sauce. We don't have as much money as like a Bass Pro Shops to donate, right? They're way bigger than us and have that, built into their budget in a way we just couldn't. So I can't match them on that. I couldn't match, everyone on all their different, every different company, every different organization in the hunting and fishing world has a different strength. What I'm realizing is we have ours. So how do I lean into that? How do we use that for the best possible good? So you know, in recent months, I've been doing a lot of thinking about that and talking to people about that and starting to build out, you know, those kinds of tools, whether that's, you know, our new Mediator News social media account we launched, which is focused just on, you know, conservation and hunting and fishing news related items to just continue to educate and inform people. Or maybe that's, you know, starting to ramp up the velocity of kind of advocacy work that we're going to be doing and using our platform to not just tell the public about what's going on, but also to directly engage with elected officials and saying, hey, we represent these millions of hunters and anglers and they care about A, B, and C. You better listen to us. That's something we maybe can uniquely do. So those are some of the things that are filling out that bullet point list.
Yeah. How do you feel? Like, because I know you, I know that you've hunted the West for a variety of species and you're in tune with the public land thing that's out West, but you're also a Michigan boy who was born and raised in Michigan. And the term public land means something different east of the Mississippi River than it does out West. Okay. Sure. So how do you feel that, or maybe you take a different approach to it, or how do you feel that the connection to Michigan in the Midwest and the eastern part of the United States, also taking advantage of public land out West, makes you suitable for what you're currently doing?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great point. Sometimes the public land set of issues, or even just conservation issues in general, get a Western hyper-focus because that's where so much of that stuff is. And I've definitely felt that being a Michigan guy saying like, hey, what about us over here?
Yeah.
I don't, you know, this isn't just a Montana thing or just a Utah thing or just a Arizona thing like this. You know, I wish there'd be more attention on Michigan or Maine or Florida or South Carolina. And so I think what I can bring to the table, what I hope I can bring to the table is like you said, a clear understanding of the Western side, but also personal experience to the East and the Midwest. And also recognition that when we're talking conservation, it's not just a public land thing. Yeah. Private lands are immensely important when it comes to hunting and fishing opportunities and wildlife habitat. Like, I mean, immensely. There's more private land. There's more opportunity in many cases. There's so many. You know, there's 440 million acres of land in America right now that are primarily owned or leased for wildlife-related recreation. I think 360 or 380 million acres of that, the primary use is hunting. So that is a larger footprint than the national park system. That's a larger footprint than the national forest system. That's a larger footprint than the Bureau of Land Management system, right? So like all of our major public land systems are dwarfed by the amount of private land owned or leased for hunting.
Yeah.
So if we're talking about the conservation impact that could be made, that 400 some acres, 400 million some acres is a massive canvas for positive conservation impacts for wildlife or negative if it's being, you know, taken care of in the wrong way. So that's a huge part of what I want to make sure that we talk about, that the world is thinking about and talking about is, hey, how are we thinking about wildlife and wild places on these private lands? How can we make a difference on these private lands? Yeah. How do we help empower and help private landowners to do the best work they possibly can on those places? Part of that comes down to access and making sure that hunters and anglers can get on these places and be a part of those landscapes. Some of that teaching about how to steward these places. Some of this is advocating for programs that are federal programs, but that fund private land stuff, like all of the programs through the Farm Bill. That's the largest funding mechanism for private land conservation. Mm-hmm. So I think that having my Michigan experience, I hope, is going to help with that. I hope having somebody who has like a whitetail and turkey and bass fishing and walleye fishing background will be a breath of fresh air, you know, into this world while also still living a big chunk of my life out West too, so I can relate and have that experience as well. So I think everyone brings a different something to the table, and I'm going to bring what I have and hope to use it for the best.
Yeah. I want to talk about attention for a second time. Let's not attention, but time for the average Joe. Okay, man. Like one of my biggest hurdles working with any conservation organization is, and I, this has to tie in a little bit of what you just said, that with all that private land and all the potential conservation efforts that could be done on those public lands and really make a difference on habitat, asterisks, not everybody gets to use private land. You know what I mean? So for me, I've always been like, man, where's my money going to on some of these organizations? And you know what they are, NWTF, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, National Deer Association, or Alliance. Is it Alliance or Association?
It's Association.
No. Association, yeah, National Deer Association. And so like, I look at that and I go, well, my money's just going to who knows what, when I could probably contribute more time, energy, and money to a local effort and see direct results on that. Is there a flaw in that way of thinking?
I think you make a good point in that, you know, you're probably going to be able to see the impact on those local efforts more so, and maybe even have more of an impact locally.
Yeah.
But I personally would, and I know everyone, you know, time is our greatest asset and tough to find it. But I would personally try to look at it not as an either or, but both.
Yeah.
You know, those national organizations do serve a really important role. They can inform, they can reach people at a different level. They can provide the information and the assets, and they have the ability to reach a scale that you couldn't yourself, myself, we couldn't. So we need those organizations to be able to operate well. So our membership dues help make that possible. You know, they're able to make an impact in a different way that we can. So I wouldn't want to ever see those go away. So I want to make my membership payments and help out when I can. But to your point, it's hard to see the impact there. It's hard to make a huge difference as an individual at that scale. That's why, to your point, doing a local thing, you know, you can see that difference. And I look at like the local hands-on action as a way to refuel the gas tank. A lot of this stuff can be like draining, right? Like paying attention to some, like the Ballinger Waters issue and watching that kind of do what it did, that can be draining, that can be discouraging, that can feel like, oh man, we all tried to make a big ruckus about this and it still went through, nobody listens to us, this sucks, and that can be discouraging. But when you go out and work on a local project where you actually, you know, get your hands dirty, maybe literally like working the ground, or maybe you're just working on a project in your local community and helping out in a different way, but that stuff, when you actually see something coming from the work you did, when you're surrounded by other people in real life who care about the same thing and who are doing something too, that fills you with energy. That's like creating a reservoir of hope and agency. That's like rocket fuel.
Yeah.
So I've been trying to find more ways to do that myself because it makes me feel better. It makes me feel like I'm making a difference. I do get to see that difference I can make. It connects me with other people who care about other stuff, and that community is like energizing as well. So at least in my life, I'm trying to find ways to make a little bit of a space for both of those. And I think they build off each other.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. You recently went to Washington, D.C., and this is where I am very intrigued about. Okay. So we both watched Game of Thrones, correct?
Yes.
Watched it. All right.
Yep.
And I'm going to pull up one of the last episodes of Game of Thrones from the last season where the Ice King shows up. All right. He's got his army of the dead and they're just relentless.
Yeah.
Right. And then that magical witch starts a fire all the way around the castle. And there's a breath there where the good guys in this scenario, they just get a breath. They just have a breath where they're just like, whew, finally the fighting stopped just for a second. And then the dead soldiers start to jump on the fire and then their faces turn and it's like, holy shit, they're still coming.
Yeah.
They're still coming. And for some reason, I don't know why I'm using this as a metaphor for people trying to sell public lands, right? Because it just seems that no matter how hard our public land support group fights, the resources and the politicians on the other side are not fazed by what we're doing at all. And they just keep coming and they keep coming and they keep coming, and they don't give a shit about what we're saying or how many of us there are supporting public lands. They have one goal in mind, and that's to get rid of it. Okay.
Yeah.
You had a little trip to DC. What did you encounter there?
Yeah. So to the analogy to like the Ice King's troops continue to advance no matter what we do, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of truth to that. You know, I started paying a lot of attention to this. Gosh, what? I mean,
maybe 15
years ago is when I started kind of figuring it out. And then, of course, like working on that first book project of mine all about the public land fight. Mm-hmm. You know, I got really deep into this starting like 2016. And what I learned as I look back in the history of this thing was that it's been going on since day one. They've been trying to tear down or sell off or get rid of our public lands since it began back in the end of the 1800s, all the way through the 1900s to now. So it's always been that way. It's always going to be that way. There's this massive asset, which is this land base that we have as Americans. It's an incredible inheritance we have. And when we look at it, we see one thing, which is incredible access to wildlife and wild places and hunting and fishing and camping and quiet space and gorgeous starry skies and all that good stuff that we live for. But when other people look at it, they see dollars. They see opportunity to make a buck. They see an opportunity to milk it for a whole bunch of change. It's always going to be that way. So that, number one, is just like something that we have to come to terms with. Mm-hmm. This is not a fight. This isn't a war we're ever going to win. This is a series of battles that are just going to be a part of life forever. That can be kind of disheartening in one way, but if you kind of come to terms with it and recognize, okay, this is just the terms of the engagement, and you can make peace with that, then it's maybe a little bit less discouraging when the fight keeps coming back again and again, because it shouldn't be a surprise.
Right.
It shouldn't be, you know, oh my gosh, how could this possibly happen again? I'm not surprised anymore. I'm just waiting for the next shoe to drop and then being ready for it, trying to arm ourselves for it. But you brought up the fact that, right, why is there so much energy and so many resources attached to trying to tear down our public land system? And I would point out that as I've kind of started to better understand what's going on at the federal level and the politics level, there is this arm, there is this group of people who are kind of diabolically opposed or diametrically opposed to public lands that want to do these things we're talking about. But that's a relatively small slice of people. There's a strongly supported, well-resourced group of people and industries that want to, you know, get rid of public lands or leverage them 100% just for profit. Mm-hmm. And then there's another group of folks, politicians and thought leaders and organizations, who look at public lands as, hey, these should be protected and cherished and conserved, etc. But then there's this very big group in the middle who kind of don't know much about it, who don't care much about it, who have all their priorities and they have other things going on in their worlds. And they're just impacted by whichever way the political moment sways them, right? They're towing the party line. They're doing whatever their boss tells them to do, or whatever the majority leader tells them to do, or whatever their constituents force them to do by way of public, support or otherwise. Yeah. So that's where there is this possibility someday to be able to sway things in our direction, but that takes time. So when I go to DC or when I engage in some of these conversations, while it seems a little bit disheartening right now, to your point, like again with the Boundary Waters example, you know, there's so much public opposition to this change in protections, but still they did it anyways. There was a majority still voted to remove this mineral withdrawal that protected the area around the Boundary Waters. So, man, that sucks. It seems like we can't win, even though we made so much noise and though so many people fought to stop this thing. I have seen, though, in conversations, in statements, in, you know, meetings that I've been in, there is a growing awareness and a growing concern, even from Republicans, who unfortunately are like the ones who are driving a lot of this, that are seeing like, man, we don't want to have to vote this way. We are getting so much pushback. Like, I sat down with a senator in this meeting who basically said, like, there's not been anything we've heard as loudly about as much as this public land thing right now. Like, we are being shouted at from all sides on this, and we don't want to have to vote against it because I know it's not popular in my state, and this is not going to go well for us and me. And so we are actively trying to do some stuff behind the scenes to, you know, make things a little bit better. But there's all these political realities that they're dealing with on their side that force them sometimes to make these votes. And that sucks, and I hate that.
Okay, stop.
Okay.
What is forcing them? Like, when you look at democracy, I vote, and all of these people vote for you because of what you are telling us you're going to do for us. Okay? Fast forward, whatever. Now, all of these people, whether they're in your voting area or not, are telling you, do not do this. We do not support this. And a majority of people are telling you not to do something. And then your excuse is, hey, I'm sorry, my hands are tied. I can't vote that way. That seems like the biggest bullshit answer I've ever heard of. So your hands are not tied. They're not. Something else is influencing your decision making aside from what you're supposed to do, and that's vote for the majority. Unless there's some kind of other, like, very non-confrontational majority telling you to do that.
Yeah, I agree with you, of course. And that's the shitty part of this, is that these folks have a number of different interests that they seem to be beholden to. And there's all of this, all the stuff that we assume is going on is probably going on, right?
Right.
People are being, you know, their coffers are being filled by lobbying groups and by industry groups and by other people that are saying, hey, we really want you to take this position and we're going to help fund your campaign. Mm-hmm. So these people are influenced by that. There are all of these, I'm struggling to think what the right word is for this, but like, there's like jockeying going on within each of these parties to get different priorities done. So let's just say, you know, Senator A has a project in his, you know, area, like a bridge. He really wants to get this bridge built because he thinks it's going to be great for his community. And he thinks that people will be excited about that. It'll keep him, you know, voted for in the future. Right. So he really wants that bridge to get done. And then there's some other senator who doesn't give a shit about the bridge, but he really wants to get his, you know, some new big manufacturing facility brought into their community, right? And so every different senator, every different representative, they all have their own list of stuff like that. And they can't get any of their stuff done without other people helping them out. And so they're all making these deals like, hey, if you'll vote for me on this bridge thing that really matters to me, I'm going to help you out with this other thing to help you get this manufacturing facility in for you. And so imagine that multiplied by 100 senators and Lord knows how many different representatives. And then you also have each party saying, well, then there's this stuff that the president wants, or well, now there's the stuff that like the Democratic Party wants. And we really need everybody to toe the line on this because it's important because of A, B, and C. So you have all these different conflicting forces going down to each one of these people, plus those money interests, which every politician has from different angles. And that's why you then get to this point where, unfortunately, our representative system does not always accurately represent the actual interests of the majority. It is an imperfect system. It's the best system we've got, but it is still imperfect. And that's very frustrating. And that can feel often like it's bullshit. And so all we can do, as far as I can tell, is continue to make it so inconvenient, so much a pain in the ass, so politically dangerous and risky for them to vote against us, that eventually some, we're never going to get them all, but maybe some will say, okay, I do want to get reelected next time. So I am seeing now the pressure is so immense on these issues, I can't ignore it anymore. And there's some, like, imagine it's like a volume setting. And imagine there's all of those other things we just talked about, all those other pressures pushing them to go one way. If we're putting pressure on them at like a 1 or a 2 or a 3 or 4 on that volume, they're going to say, ah, it's not that important. I'm going to go where the money is pushing me. I'm going to go where my, you know, rest of my party is pushing me, et cetera. If we turn the volume to 11, then sometimes they have to listen. So, for example, last summer during the public land sell-off, right? That was all the whole reconciliation package that was all being pushed by the Republican side of the aisle. And I don't like to look at things from a partisan perspective. I think conservation just is what it should is. Be bipartisan, but it is what it is, right?
Yep.
And so the Republican side of the aisle was pushing this package through, and the president wanted this thing to get passed. So there was tons of political pressure to get this thing over the finish line as it was. But we turned the volume up to 11 in a huge, huge way. So much so that some Republican representatives and some Republican senators had to come out and say, okay, I can't do this public land thing. Even though they were getting tons of pressure internally, I'm sure, to do it.
Yeah.
It was so politically poisonous that they had to say, okay, you know, there was, you know, the senators from Montana and the senators from Idaho all came out and say, hey, we can't do this. You guys have got to change this because this one's going to sink us.
Yeah.
And so that's what we have to make happen more consistently. That's what we have to happen, create for more issues. It's not easy to do. It's a pain in the ass to do. We'd all rather be hunting and fishing and not worrying about this stuff. I would rather be doing that than having to travel to DC and put on a suit and have these conversations.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a necessity these days.
The issue becomes, how long can our speakers remain at an 11? You know what I mean? That's where it's just like, I care about public lands. I care about making sure that wildlife has a place to live and thrive for all to enjoy it. But I can't focus on that 40 hours a week, dude. Like, I can't sit here and just type on my computer all day long trying to email representatives and shit like that. And yes, there's places that you can go and do it. It's just that at some point, the resources that the opposers have to this thing just seem infinite. And it just keeps overwhelming. It's like going to battle again. And you're just like, I'm exhausted from this shit, dude.
Yeah.
So with that said, is when we got really close here in Iowa with the Iowa Bow Hunters Association on a couple things where that organization got really close to being on the offensive and putting like a memorandum on any rules and regulations that could be implemented against of what we were trying to do. Right. Is that even a reality on the sale of public lands where federally you're just like, dude, nothing even close to the sale of public lands for the next 10 years.
Yeah, it is a possibility. There's actually been a bill introduced that would do that. It would cap any kind of public land sale proposal at either 300 acres or 500 acres without some like massive hurdles you would have to cross to ever get that across the finish line. So it would put a really, really, really big roadblock in the way of ever something like that happening again.
Yeah.
That is an opportunity. It's not advanced yet. It was introduced in the House, I guess, with Zinke and I think Gabe Vasquez was attached to that on the Democratic side. So a Republican and a Democrat introduced that in the House. It just hasn't moved forward. But yeah, like that kind of thing would be amazing to get out there.
Yeah.
I do think trying to find ways to get on the offensive is great and necessary. Not easy. Mm-hmm. And to your point, all of this stuff is exhausting. None of us have time to devote all of our time to this. But when I look at that, I think we all just need to do whatever it is we have the bandwidth to do, because the alternative is just throwing our hands up and saying, okay, well, we don't have time for this. And then they're just going to do whatever they want to do. And that's also not a alternative I think a lot of us are willing to live with, because we need these places. We love these places and these opportunities. So there's going to have to be some kind of, I feel like I can only speak for myself, but 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I just hunted and went fishing, and that was all I ever did. And that's all I thought about, was just like using it. I loved it. Yep. I used it. I wanted to get the most out of that experience. And then somewhere along the way over the years, then I learned like, oh, there's an opportunity to help sometimes. I would like to do that sometimes. So then I started doing that sometimes. And then I got to a point where I realized, oh, well, you know, hunting and fishing is conservation. Part of what we're doing is helping conservation. Our license sales go to help conservation and, you know, managing these wildlife populations. That's great. So I'm already a part of that. So that's a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally I got to the point where I realized, oh, none of that's enough. Because if I want this stuff to continue in the future, I've got to make the license purchase, right? That helps. I want to help because I enjoy helping. I want to do that. I want to use these things, enjoy these things. But now, like, a prereq is having to be engaged in a bigger way. Like, maybe in 1970, we were in a position where you could choose to do that. And it was great. But even if you didn't, stuff would carry on great. It's 2026, and there are so many pressures from so many different places in this crazy, growing, modern world we live in now. If we just continue on with the status quo, we're not going to have this stuff. Our kids aren't going to have this stuff in the long term. So it's an inconvenient reality that at least I think we all have to come to terms with, that just part of being a hunter and angler moving forward is going to be also having to be an advocate for this stuff.
Yeah.
Like, it just is, or we're not going to have it. That's just the reality. And I've just decided, like, okay, I'm going to face that reality head on and figure out what I can do with the time I have and the resources I have to do my part in that. Because I do not want to live in a world where we can't hunt or we can't fish or we don't have land to go do these things. It just matters too much to me and my kids and so many of us.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to provide you with two recent examples. One is conservation related, and the other is kind of just like political scum. And so one was like 12 years ago, the state of Iowa voted that they would approve of, like, I think it was a 1 penny tax increase or 1 or 2 penny tax increase in order to help fund conservation efforts, state parks, like wildlife habitat improvement, water quality, things like that. And it passed. But then the political parties got involved and they decided, oh, well, we can't agree on anything. And I think it was like 70% of Iowa's approved of this. So it's a no-brainer to implement, right? And after the last 12 years, it still has not been implemented because both political parties were making their statements on trying to put into this bill what they feel should be it, like, things that don't even matter. I look at stuff like that and I go, it's a yes or a no. You either do it or you don't do it. The Iowans want it, so do it, right? Yeah. And of course, they can't agree on what it is that goes into this. And both political parties have kind of messed it up. And therefore, I believe it was like hundreds of millions of dollars that has been kind of lost or not necessarily lost, but not generated over the course of the last 12 years for something like this, right? And so it's just
frustrating.
There's a specific, I'm blanking on the name of this program. It's like I Weep or I something like that. Anyway, that's one example. The other example is this data center that's going up, and I would kind of put this in the mine category for the boundary waters.
Yep.
Okay. So the data centers come in and the data centers go, oh, well, we want to buy and we want to put data centers in here. The city of where this is at, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, says, guess what? You cannot drill the wells that you need because we're talking about millions and millions of gallons of water, I believe a day, that are going to be used at on these data centers. And then once this water is used, it is no longer, it's poisonous, right? It can't be dumped back into the river. It can't be stored. It's just, it has to be dealt with, right? And so the city goes, okay, you can't drill the wells that you need to this because we think it's going to impact the surrounding communities. So do you know what the data center did? They drilled the wells anyway, and they paid the fines instead of halting the construction of these data centers. They just said, we have so much money, we'll just pay the $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 fines. And then they still built them anyway.
Wow.
How much of a slap in the face is that to the local community in a scenario like this? Like, that's what's going on, not only on a federal level with your politicians, but at a local level with your politicians. Like, who got promised what is what I want to know, right?
Yeah.
And so then you kind of fast forward this to the mines that they're thinking about creating up in the boundary waters, right?
Yeah.
Let's try to look at this in a positive for just a moment. This mine being creative may stimulate the economy. It might offer employment for people who need employment. It might get, like the cascade of dollars down into the community, which might mean that the community would thrive, that there might be some more tax dollars in there. There could be different program and opportunities with that dollar amount. But there's a threat that it poisons the water leading out into the boundary waters, right? So, and you can use that as the example here. Do you feel that the threat of pollution and impacting the neighboring boundary waters is so high that it outweighs the other economic benefits that that mine might have to the community?
Yeah. So I think that, in many cases, let me take a step back and make a blanket statement, which is, yep. I recognize that we need resources. We need to have mines. We need to log timber. We need oil and gas, and we need all these resources that we extract from the landscape, right?
Yeah.
We're using cell phones and laptops and driving cars and doing all the stuff. So that let's first off recognize that we have to find ways to acquire these resources. But we also need to recognize that the natural world provides immense value to our lives, not just the recreational value that we've been talking about, but also we need clean water to drink. We need trees to create the clean oxygen we need to breathe. We need to, there's all of these ways that the natural world actually forms a foundation for us to do everything. Like, we call this ecosystem services that these landscapes provide, that if we destroy them, we can't continue living the way we do. So we have to find ways to moderate what we extract, to manage what we extract, and to do it in such a way that it is low impact as it possibly can. We need to create technologies to find ways to do this in a better, cleaner, more efficient way. We also need to be smart and careful about where we place these things. And there's some places that are simply too high risk, where there's these other sides of the equation that have to be factored. And so in the Boundary Waters example, that's the case. There could be a positive impact of having a mine. There's jobs attached to that, yes. But there are also many, many jobs that are tied to the recreation opportunities that are tied to a healthy landscape in the boundary waters. There's a massive recreational economy there, tourism economy there, that would not exist anymore if the waters there were poisoned and fish couldn't live there anymore and you couldn't drink that water anymore. You wouldn't want to go canoeing out there and spend time there. And so while there's an opportunity cost to not allowing that mine and not allowing those the number of jobs that would be there tied to that mine, you have to also consider the very large number of jobs and visitors and dollars tied to keeping the boundary waters healthy. And also the long-term implications there. Having this mine, there is a certain time-boundness to that, right? There's a deposit there of resources that will eventually be extinguished. We will run out of those resources and that mine will close. There's a end date to that. Mm. The resources available in the boundary waters, that being clean water, open landscapes, healthy, wildlife and fish populations there, that should and can exist into perpetuity. That's a forever resource. Mm-hmm. That's something that can forever be used by Americans. That is a set of jobs and economic impacts that's not a 20-year time span. That's a 200-year time span or a 2,000-year time span. So there's this enormous long tail that we have to consider there. And so those two things combined have led many to say, yeah, we need copper ore sulfide mines, sulfide ore copper mines some places. But this is such a high risk location for it because of what I just described. Mm-hmm. Why do we have to place something like this upstream of the watershed that spreads all the way through the boundary waters? This is an incredibly highly risky mine. Every single other mine like this in history has polluted, has had issues. Why would we place that right next to this incredibly sensitive, highly valued water resource? It's the most visited wilderness in the United States. It represents 20% of all of the fresh water in our U.S. forest system. All of it right there, now at risk from this highly risky mine.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it comes down to, really picking our placement, really picking how we execute in these things. And in this case, wrong kind of mine in the wrong kind of place. impacting a bunch of different types of people, a bunch of opportunities, a bunch of ecosystem services. So that's why it was one of these issues that had to be raised to the top that really does deserve a lot of time and attention.
Yeah. So how much of this actually has to do with, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's not even an American company who is proposing this mine, right? It's a Chilean mine, right? Yep. So does that change perspective from some people if it is a United States based company?
I think it just hurts their argument. Like on that side of the issue, part of the argument is like, hey, this is good for the economy. Hey, this is good for jobs. I think their argument is weakened when you say, well, a massive amount of the dollars accrued from this project will be sent overseas to other countries. The capital gains, much of the capital gains is going to benefit somebody in some other country. So this is not helping the U.S. economy in the ways that some would argue it was. This is not going to be this massive ripple effect of economic impact for regular people like us in the United States. This is going to enrich a handful of elites in different countries and a handful of elites in this nation who are helping them make this happen. And then, of course, yes, there will be some people on the ground that work in these mines. Good people, probably many hunters and anglers, you know, who live up in northern Minnesota, who work these jobs and work hard and they do good work. And I am very appreciative of folks in those communities and the work they're doing. This is not an indictment of the mining industry, of regular people working in these jobs and these companies. We need them. We appreciate them. But this is simply a recognition of, This is one of those places and things that we got to do really carefully and in the right places. And this just ain't one of them.
Yeah. Okay. Kind of going back to when you were in DC, and you had meetings with what sounded like several, like 20 senators or representatives
I got to meet face to face with 4 congressmen, 1 senator, and then the director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and one of the advisors for the Secretary of the Interior. That's the guy that sits over top all of our public land agencies and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And then a bunch of meetings with people, kind of advisors, lobbyists, conservation organization people, a bunch of folks like that are kind of like circling around.
Gotcha. All of that. Okay. With those encounters, did you ever feel like they were just straight up lying to your face? Or even like, I don't want to say worse yet, because obviously telling the truth is better than lying. But like any of those politicians just straight up tell you, I have no interest in what you're saying, or I'm still going to move forward with whatever program, or for example, that mine is just like, I'm doing it, dude. So whatever.
So what I saw most of the time, there's a couple different things. There's some politicians that are experts at just changing the subject to whatever they want to talk about. So like if I were to say, okay, so there's this Boundary Waters issue going on that could impact fish and water quality, and then they'll jump in and be like, man, you're right, water is a really important thing. I used to work on this golf course, and when I was at this golf course, you know, we really like to make sure we irrigated all the greens really well. And when I was 18, there was this gal, Holly was her name. And, you know, she was just terrific. And we worked together. We put together this plan to irrigate the greens. And then he'll talk for 25 minutes and use up the entire span that you're supposed to be there to talk about this one issue, about this bullshit that they're just trying to clog you up.
So I filibuster. The old filibuster. Yeah. Holy shit.
So there was some filibustering going on. And you would have to, like, try to accurately cut him off. Like, sorry. We got to talk about X. Could you please hear me on Y? So that happened. Then there was other people who would nod their head and say, yeah, that's important. I really like this thing. I really support hunting or fishing, or I used to go visit, you know, X National Park, whatever. So they kind of throw you a bone and say, yeah, that matters. But then again, they would not acknowledge that they're going to change their position. They would just kind of like hear you out. I've had one who did say like, hey, I came down differently on the issue than you guys. Because I believe that they can do this and that the technology is better. I had some people who would, you know, I guess I respect that. They would acknowledge a difference in opinion and say that they just saw it differently. I had another meeting, not while I was in DC, but just prior to the vote on this particular issue, where they were quite combative. They tried to argue every single point with us. Mm-hmm. So that was an interesting one. But yeah, I think a lot of these times you'll just get them push the conversation where they want to go. You would have them kind of ignore any real points that you bring up and try to steer it in a way that they can kind of say something that sort of appeases you, but at the same time is kind of fluff.
Yeah.
And that's frustrating. And it's, you know, in many of these cases, it's not going to make a difference right away. But I view this as like a long game. Like we have to keep on banging on the door over and over and over again from so many different angles and from so many different people that eventually a couple of the doors come down.
Yeah.
And to the earlier conversations, like the alternative is just to throw your hands up and say, we give up, take whatever you want. And I don't think that's an acceptable alternative either.
No. I will say this. It's better that Mark Kenyon is in those rooms with people than Dan Johnson, because some guy tries to fluff me for 45 minutes and changes the subject. The end of that conversation with a guy like me ends in, does it feel good to be a huge piece of shit? Like, you know, I say that to their face because I'm just like, you did exactly what everybody thinks politicians do. And that's waste time and fluff people and just like, what? Every stereotype about a politician is true with what you just did, right? I almost respect the guy who maybe was even a little combatant and argued with you, or at least straight up told you what he was going to do, than some douchebag who was just didn't have the guts to tell you what they were going to do, right? Yeah. And still, and I know that doesn't change too much of everything that's going on. And yes, it's possibly a long game, but the long game is that mine's being built. That mine is going to be built. And I hope that that the technology is better. And I hope that somehow, in some way, shape, or form, they have it figured out to where there's less pollutants going into that water, or the environmental impact is way, 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 way low, which statistics say it's probably not going to be. But again, like, I don't know, dude. This is where it gets like, you know, you can't just walk around telling people to go fuck themselves. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Here's what I'll say, though.
Yeah.
As much as all of what you just said is true, and as frustrating as that is, like, not just frustrating, like infuriating.
Yeah.
That is. We also don't need to change a whole lot of minds to change the outcome.
Right.
Given the kind of political reality we're in right now, sometimes one vote is the difference, right? I mean, that's the case with the boundary waters thing. It was a 50 to 49 vote. We just needed to change one more person's mind on this to get it to go the other way. So it's not like we have to make all the, we don't need to get everybody. We just need to occasionally get one or two here and there. And that seems achievable. And, you know, last summer we did, we got more than one or two to go our way.
Yeah.
There's going to be other issues where we can do that. So again, like, this is an imperfect system. This is a cruddy system in a lot of ways, but at the same time, it's the best we got. One thing that was encouraging while I was there was, like, when I'm in the office buildings for the representative, for the House of Representatives, it's a very clear illustration of the unique chance that we get to actually go do this. Like, there's all these very, you know, highly in demand congressmen and women just walking around the halls with you, and I can walk into any one of these rooms and sit down with them and tell them how I feel and tell them how our community feels. Like, that's not the case in a lot of countries. So even though some of these guys are going to give us a hard time, some of them won't listen to us, we also have this very unique, that sometimes does help our cause, opportunity to sit down with them and share these thoughts and these ideas and apply this pressure and get to, you know, walk the halls of them and say, hey, you better listen, because there's millions of hunters and anglers who do care about this stuff, and you better get right on it. And so getting to see that firsthand and see thousands and thousands of other regular people like me and you in there doing the same thing, that was still encouraging to see.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, it just sucks. I don't know. Like, this was a long time ago, but I had a conversation about conservation burnout. Because I feel like people do try really hard to to put in energy and effort towards conservation, and then it still doesn't go their way in some certain, is there, going back to that, Boundary Waters mine, is there still hope that somehow that gets pushed aside or shelved and it doesn't turn out that way? Or is it too late?
It's not too late. That's okay. The good news is, like, this mineral withdrawal that just got removed, that was a massive, like, protective roadblock put around things. Mm-hmm. Now that's gone, but there's still a bunch of hurdles that the mining company will have to go through. There's going to be several different environmental reviews they have to go through with the federal government and the state government, and then permits they have to apply for. And all of that could get hung up, and it's going to take a while, especially if there's a lot of public pressure to slow it down more.
Yeah.
There also could be litigation that could slow things down even more. So probably our best hope is that some combination of those things slows this thing down enough that we get to a different political administration someday that is against this, and the mine still hasn't gone into place. And then that administration could put protections back in and maybe find some way to make it more permanent, through legislation would be the way to do that. So yeah, this isn't all the way done. This was a big hit. This is a battle lost, but it is not the end of the end. And just have to head to the next battle. Like I said, like, these things are just going to continue to happen. And you're right, burnout is a real thing. That's why I think, like, if we're going to spend 10 minutes on, you know, this advocacy, then we got to spend an hour outside. Get out there, hunt, fish, camp, explore. Get out there and be reminded about why this matters. Be reminded of why we are going to do these fights and make these calls, because, man, it's so damn good out there. It's so great. It's so important. So refuel the gas tank. Get that energy. And that's at least what, for me, has been able to keep me keeping on.
Yeah. And that's a good way to kind of shut her down, my friend. Mark, I really appreciate you taking time out of your very busy day to hop on and BS with us for a little bit about these very important, I shouldn't even call it BS, because it's very important conversation that's we're all kind of thinking about and in the process of. So appreciate your time, man.
Hey, you were very welcome, and appreciate you having me. Always great to chat.